Blog Talk Radio.
And we are pleased to be back for part two of Carl Panzram on Scarycast Presents Murder 123. What a blast. Now, as we were talking in the green room, it's not really a room. I guess it's the green area. That's what it is for the podcast. I mentioned to Tony. I said, Tony, you really know a little bit about Carl. Seems like you've done some research on Carl. And you answered it with a very interesting comment. Kind sir, take it away.
Well, I've watched John Borowski's film on Panzram a couple times. I believe it's on Prime, Amazon Prime. So we'll plug John Borowski really quick. He did an excellent job. It was a very, very good representation. He gets into a lot of the minutia of Panzram, and the guy that did the narration did an incredible job at Panzram. So, I mean, you know, everybody needs to check it out if they're interested in Carl Panzram.
And I'll admit, I mean, I agree, John Borowski's a nice guy. I was a table buddy of his at Horror Hound last year. I mean, just a super guy. And it was a lot of fun getting to know him and talk to him. And so anyway, so we've got that. And now I would like to, if I may continue, reading a little bit more about Carl's life, because it was a rough, rough young life. I mean, he was born in Grand Forks, Minnesota, and he was the son of some Prussian immigrants, Prussia being over there near Iran, Johann and Matilda Gottlieb Panzram, and they lived on the family farm, and he had five siblings. So I guess, Tony, you were right. There were six kids in the family. And Carl was odd from a young age. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing for a biographer to say. He felt odd from a young age. I didn't know that a seven-year-old could feel odd. I mean, how do you know if they even know what odd feels like at 7 years old? But, you know, but by the age of, as I said, by 5 or 6, he was a liar and a thief. And he kept saying he was going to get meaner and meaner as he grew up. Now, Robin, I'm going to ask a question to you, because you have dealt with folks who have had premonitions about their lives and knew that it was their lives, something was going to take them somewhere great or something, or somewhere bad. You have had experiences with people like that, haven't you?
Yeah.
Now, we call people that have premonitions that they're going to have a great life, we call them goal setters, don't we? That's kind of the thing, you know. You pick somebody. You pick Barack Obama. You pick Donald Trump. You predict either the George Bushes. They all said they were going to be president of the United States early on. Now, they did. And so we call that great. What do we call it when someone says, I'm going to get meaner and meaner and kill more people as I grow older? And they say that when they're 8, 9 years old. What do you call that, Robin?
I think that's an emotionally disturbed child that needs to be getting some type of help. The other thing is, you know, because I always go to that weird paranormal side of things, you know, there is not all good in this world. There are dark things, there are dark entities, there are just a lot of things that can attach to a person, a child, that can cause an excessive amount of aggravation and hatred and all that, and the kids don't know why. Okay, it happens to adults. I've had adults get hold of me and help me get it, and I help them get it off of them. But it is possible. I'm not saying that's the situation in this case. I'm saying it is something to consider. And you have to realize a child, when it comes out, is 100% innocent. It is as open and as innocent as it can be. And I would myself, just from what you just said and what I'm reading, I want to know about the parents. I would want to know what kind of a background they had, if that's something that would bring in a dark energy that would be around the parents that might have transferred to the child. You know, what kind of parents are these? What are their mannerisms? Because a child is born innocent. And, you know, there are kids as well as adults that have mental illnesses and that can play into this. But I would also want to know that background because it plays heavy. And if these parents are what I consider dark as far as in personality and in nature, and I mean dark emotionally, I'm not talking about skin color, you know, I'm talking about emotionally, or what are they into? Does the mom do dark magic? I mean, it sounds crazy, but there's a lot of things to consider, and some of those things do come up. And it can transfer over to the kids. And if there's nothing on the mom and dad side, then why is this child not getting help? If you're a good parent and you're seeing your 5 and 6-year-old is like this, and then at age 8 they're seeing this, why are you not stepping up to the plate and making that attempt to get that kid help?
Well, true. And now, Tony, you told us about his father, right? And if you don't mind, repeat that little story about how he treated the family.
Well,
the surprise.
He left his family. Yeah, he just disappeared. He went out one day and he didn't come back. He left the mother with 6 children with a workout farm.
Well, now, hold on a minute. You said that he just evaporated into thin air?
Left, yeah. He just left them.
Well, is it possible that there could have been some foul play involved?
Maybe. We'd have to find out his name and then look for a death cert on him and see where he died. If he disappeared and there's no death cert or anything or no trace of him, then it's very, you know, it's possible.
He's down a well or something.
It could be. But now, Carl, from what I understand, he broke into a neighbor's house. If I'm not mistaken, stole some minor things, you know, some of them foodstuffs, and then stole a pistol. And
yeah.
Wanted to run away and be a cowboy. And that's whenever I think they caught him, and then they sent him to his first stint, first or second stint in reform school.
Now, you're saying he wanted to be a cowboy?
A cowboy.
That's what you said, right?
Yes, he wanted to shoot Indians, if I'm not mistaken. The connotation of that in the film that from an early age he wanted to do violence. You know, he wasn't like wanted to be a cowboy to ride the open range and play, you know, with a guitar and a horse named Trigger. He was wanting to shoot folks.
Oh, and you mean he didn't want to be like Roy Rogers and ride around in a Jeep named Nellie Bell? Oh, come on.
No. Panzeram did not want to do that. He wanted to be violent from an early age. And, you know, I'm no child psychologist, you know, but maybe that was his way of feeling important, or maybe in control. What do you think, Robin? What do you think about that?
I tend to agree with you. I do. And I mean, I think this is a kid that, regardless of how he behaved, I almost feel like it was a cover up for something. You know, I mean, I I'm going to say, I think we have to go back and investigate his home life, because you're talking about, I mean, a kid with the views that he has, the things that he did. And there is no mention anywhere about these parents. Now, I'm a mom. I had 9 children. I have 2 stepchildren. There is literally nothing on this planet I wouldn't do for those kids, or my grandchildren for that matter. If my kids were having these issues, there literally is not anything on this planet or any other planet, I would not be doing for them. And there's no mention of these parents. I just find it very odd.
Yeah, his parents, his mother didn't try to help him except put him into a reform school, and that could have been for several reasons. One, she was trying to raise five other kids, and,
mm-hmm.
and Carl just did not want to help himself in any ways.
Exactly. Well, I can understand that. I think we have to, as a parent, there are times when we have to accept the fact that there may be a situation with our kids that we can't, you know what I mean? It's almost like we have
mm-hmm.
to, in order to help them, we have to put them, you know, that could have been the situation. I'm just surprised that there's not more said about the parents. I really am. And I think he was very troubled. I think he was very conflicted.
Yeah, but now I tell you what, we're very fortunate because we have a friend who has just joined us. And I can tell you about this friend's parents. They are about the nicest people I have ever met. And this is one of our biggest fans and best friends. And we're so glad he came and joined us. Papa Stro, the Maestro of Wrestling, how are you doing tonight?
Great to be here with you guys. How are you all doing?
Absolutely. I was
doing
great.
How are you?
Yeah, I was getting ready to do a text.
How you doing?
Yeah, Robin's here. Tony's here. And we are talking
about.
Hey, Papa, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, great, brother. Great to hear from you.
We are talking about one of the most conflicted and strange serial killers in history, I believe. It's Carl Panzram. And the whole point is, when he was 6-7 years old, he stole apple, cake, and a revolver from his next door neighbor, and at like 12 years old, his parents sent him to reform school, which kind of, I think even back in 1902 or 03, I think they could have kept him out of reform school, but they did, and he was beaten and tortured, and ultimately, to catch you up on the background, he admitted to 22 murders, he admitted to over 1,000 rapes, he called himself. When he listed his occupation, when he entered his first real adult prison, he listed his occupation as thief. I mean, what can we say? And Robin was talking, she was just talking about, you know, why can't parents, I mean, do something when they see a kid is going that wrong? And, apparently, I'll give one more prop to your parents. Your parents had a lot of great kids, and they've done well, and you have been a true example to the community. So obviously, we know, as I was talking about Robin and her parents and Tony's and mine, and now yours, all of us on this broadcast are lucky enough to have great parents that knew how to train us and treat us well and get us on the good side of things. But poor old Carl, he just didn't have any help, did he, Tony?
No, he didn't have any help. He's, you know, his mother sent him to reform school, but I think that was more because she couldn't control him, and she had other children to raise. So, I guess in her mind, you know, sending him someplace where she thought he would get help to allow her to raise these other children, because you know the father had left. She's there trying to raise six children, and when Carl goes off, you know, she's still trying to raise five children. So maybe in her mind, she thought she was doing the right thing, but at any rate, she sent him to a very bad place.
She picked the wrong place to send him, and it's basically a torture chamber, and it was no good. And
yes.
And as we said right before we had our little mishap with the show, you know, he 2 years later he was so upset about being taken in the paint room, is what the kids called it, because you'd come out with bruises and blood all over you, and he just decided that he was going to burn the place down. And when he was about 12 or 13 years old, he sure bud did. I mean, that's pretty organized for a 12 or 13 year old kid. I don't know any 12 or 13 years olds. I mean, I know what they can do is all they want is a phone, and they want to get on TikTok. But I mean, you know, that's pretty much what it is. But getting back to Carl, you know, he let's see where we are. So he's in reform school. He's Minnesota State Training School, where he's tortured and beaten and raped. And then he ends up in, after he was paroled, he ended up in the Red Wing Training School. Now, you know, Red Wing is a brand of shoe, and it's been around for over 100 years, and it's actually from Minnesota. So I don't know why they would want their name attached to a training school, but he had stolen money from his mother's pocketbook. And you know, by the teens, he was an alcoholic, and he was always in trouble with the authorities. And he was up for burglary and theft all the time. And so once he ran away from home at the age of 14, they found him. He had tried to kill a Lutheran cleric, preacher, with a revolver. And so when they were closing in on him, he said, "I am getting out of here." So he jumped on a train car, and he headed somewhere else. So anyway, and he claimed, of course, when he was on board, he was raped by a group of hobos on the train. And so it just never ended for him. So he helped a friend. Yes, sir, Papa?
Why?
No, I'm just flabbergasted by the downward spiral this guy's going through.
It gets worse, buddy.
On the train car, John, there's supposed to be four hobos that first tried to coerce him into performing favors, and when he refused, that's whenever they gang raped him. And whenever he got out of the train car, according to his letters later in life, that's when he just, you know, he quit trusting humanity for obvious reasons and started formulating his attitude toward others. So that's whenever he got into the rape and sodomy of others, I think it was more of a form of control than sexual gratification.
Right, and you'd said that, and that probably was, that probably had a lot to do with Pee Wee Gaskins. Probably the same kind of thing. Because, you know, I just believe that. So anyway, he ultimately enlisted in the United States Army, and of course he was convicted of larceny, and he ended up serving a prison term from 1908 to 1910 at Fort Leavenworth. And Secretary of War at that time, William Howard Taft, approved the sentence, and Panzeram claimed that any goodness left in him was smashed out of him during his Leavenworth imprisonment, and it must have been horrible there. I mean, horrible. It's still, you know, it still has a reputation today. So anyway, he was released with a dishonorable discharge, and he resumed his career as a thief. I mean, let's face it, he at least owned up to what he said he was. He did. So he's stealing anything from bicycles to yachts, and served time under his own name and under various names. He was in Fresno. He used the name Rusk, and in Texas, he was Dallas and Oregon. Just in all these states, he had a different name, and he was in all kinds of prisons. So it's just, you know, the poor guy just never could stop. Once he got started, he never could stop. He said in his autobiography that he was rage personified, and that he would rape men that he had robbed. Again, Tony, as you said, it was a control thing. Yeah, he was also a big guy for his age, and he was very strong because of all his hard work in Leavenworth and other prisons, and that helped him in overpowering people to the county. Yeah, so it was terrible. So now, between 1910 and 20, he was just, you know, in and out of jail. He was beaten and tortured for his crimes and he was beaten and tortured for the successful escape. He ended up in New York City, and he got a seaman's identification card, and he sailed on the steamship James S. Whitney to Panama. He tried to steal a boat with the help of a drunk sailor. The drunk sailor killed everyone on board, and he was arrested. Panzeram got away. He traveled to Peru to work in a copper mine, traveled to Chile, Texas, London, Edinburgh, Paris, and Hamburg, Germany. He was quite the world traveler. He got around a lot in more ways than one. So he did get to travel a little bit, and he would have been very young at that time. He would have been in his mid 20s, and he was arrested in 1928 in Baltimore, stealing a radio and some jewelry from a dentist. And then when he was being interrogated, this is his undoing. He confessed to the killing of three young boys earlier that month, one in Oregon, one in Connecticut, and then a newsboy in Philadelphia. He said that he had, now this is great. This is what Tony had alluded to earlier. Panzram later wrote he had contemplated mass killings and other acts of mayhem, such as poisoning a city's water supply with arsenic or scuttling a British warship in New York Harbor to provoke a war between the U.S. and Britain. So there you go, Tony. He was after a big game. He wanted to start a war, and if things had gone a little bit differently, he could have.
Now, about that time frame, there's another story that he broke into a house, and I think close to Salem, that were somewhere in that area. It's where William Taft, the ex-president of the United States, and
the ex-secretary of war, that put him in Leavenworth.
And he had bonds. This is just by chance that he had ended up with a bunch of bonds. And you got two different stories. One is he got the bonds and he bought a boat. He hired some sailors to help him, do his thing, and that he may have killed some of those sailors on that cruise. And then there's, it's hard to separate fact from fiction sometimes with this guy, but either story, it was very violent. Whichever way it did happen, it was really violent.
Yes, it really was. And you know, Robin, you're good at kind of taking a look into people's heart and soul sometimes. So by the time he's 37, 38 years old, was he pretty much a goner?
Yeah. He was so angry and so void of emotion, he never let himself feel anything. He just acted. You know, he was like this hollow hole, and he stayed angry and empty.
Do you think that was a survival mechanism?
I think so.
Was there any reports of any mental illness before he started doing all these atrocious atrocities?
No mental illness, just abuse. He sustained a whole lot of abuse when he was really, really young.
I see. Okay.
He was, in other words, Pee Wee. There's a lot of similarities between Pee Wee Gaskins and Carl Panzram. I mean, Pee Wee was in school at age 8. He was beaten, tortured, and raped continually because he was a small guy from age 8. Carl Panzram at age 12 got in the same situation with Minnesota Reform School, tortured, beaten, and raped constantly every day, just like Pee Wee Gaskins. And,
what that could do to somebody's psyche, you know what I mean?
Huh. I mean, you got to ask yourself, why, the mental hospitals, they call them hospitals, they're in Europe, were just as treacherous. They really were. I mean, when I was busy writing Aliens, UFOs, and Anomalies, and I talk about that brilliant painting by, the Scream by Ebard Munk, and his mother was put in an insane asylum and tortured and raped over in Norway. And, you don't normally think of places like that as being just so uber violent. But I guess in the, and we're talking about there around like 1880, 1890, so kind of about the same time frame as Carl Pangram, there was just a total lack of respect for human life. And it's just amazing how bad it was. I mean, you know, and but then again, you know, and something that people don't talk about, and I lived through this a little bit because there was a time when electroshock therapy was considered a good thing for depression, not a nice little pill that could help. And there were, I mean, that had lasting effects on people. It destroyed them mentally. I had friends in my family, you know, there were people that had depression, and they just shot them right over to Broughton Hospital and gave them electroshock therapy, and they couldn't even get out of a bed for 30 days. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And
wow.
It did more damage than it did anything else.
Well, it did, and we have such an odd culture, you know, that we're so about helping people and being good, and then all of a sudden we have these things that just go unnoticed, like the horrible treatment that kids get in form school, that adults get in prisons, and the way we treated the mentally ill, and so, you know, it's great that we've got, for better or worse, it's better that we've got people watching out for these folks, because they can't watch out for themselves, and their families can't either. So it was a horrible situation, and it's not perfect today by any means, but it's better than it was. So and you know, it just makes you worry about, you know, the way people are treated now. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, and we'll just get on back to the end of the death row. Now, this is an interesting thing. When he got on death row, Pangram was befriended by an officer named Henry Lesser. Henry gave him money to buy cigarettes, and he also gave him pencils and paper so that he could write things down. And it began, you know, in my life, I've murdered 21 human beings. I've committed thousands of burglaries, robberies, larcenies, and arsons. And last but not least, I've committed sexual abuse on over 1,000 males. For all these things, I'm not in the least bit sorry. But yet, he found that somebody helped him, and it completely changed the way he looked at everything. It was too late, obviously, too little too late. And he was hanged on September 5th, 1930. And the boy was 39 years old. And this is just the clincher. The officers attempted to place a black hood over his head, and he spat in the executioner's face. When he asked for any last words, he responded, "Yes, hurry it up, you Hoosier bastards. I could kill a dozen men while you're screwing around." And he's buried at the Leavenworth Penitentiary Cemetery, and it is not marked with his name, only his prison number, 31614. What a horrible end to such a troubled life. And, you know, for all the bad things that he did, that didn't, well, I mean, I think it would not have been this bad had he been born, 100 years later. But then again, we don't know. Maybe this was just his destiny and what was going to happen. Carl Pangram was truly a monster. But again, why was he a monster? Look at the treatment that he got when he was 12, 13, 14 years old. It was absolutely horrible. And
monsters create monsters.
Yeah.
Well, now, Papa Stroke,
honestly,
100% right, yeah. Yes, Robin?
If there's nobody that gives a damn, and he's doing this, and he doesn't have anybody in his corner, and even after he moved away from home and now he's an adult, and if there's just nobody there for him, it just feels to me like it fuels that anger.
Yeah. I mean, that's why one reason, a good friend who's a counselor said, "I don't care who you meet. If they mention a problem to you and they don't know you that well, that's an indication that they won't help. Go ahead and give it to them.
Yeah.
Be kind to them. Be nice to them. That's the only cue that you need, is if someone tells you something that's upsetting and they don't know you very well. It's the kind of person you need to help, and you need to find out a little bit more about what's going on. And I think that's a good and valuable lesson. So now, Tony, what else, since you've seen this movie by John Burkowski, do you have any other things that you could say about Carl that you learned from the movie?
Yeah, like whenever they were taking him to walking him from his cell to the gallows, whenever that they went in to get him, there was some clergy, and he went crazy and said, you know, I don't want these hypocrites walking with me to the gallows. You get them out of here, I'll fight you all the way to the gallows. You know, I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. And so the clergy left, and whenever they got him out and he was walking toward the gallows, shackled, he was leading the guards. He wasn't pulling and crying, begging for his life. He was pulling the guards like a dog on a chain up to the gallows. And there was the fellow's name eludes me, but he wrote, there was a guy that was close to Pan Dram, and they talked back and forth, and he had written a book about the prison system, and I'll find the link and I'll send you the guy's name, but he, in one of the chapters of the book, he was there with Pan Dram. It's the death of Carl Pan Dram, and it actually backs up a lot of the claims, you know, about him pulling the guards and him spitting, you know, on the captain of the guard, allegedly, and things like that. So Carl Pan Dram was a real deal bad guy. He was, I think, Carl, you know, Papa Stroh hit on it about him being, was there any mental issues? I think after that abuse, when he was young, how could you not have mental issues? You know, mm-hmm. this guy had snapped, I mean, at an early age. So I think Carl Pan Dram, I don't think he was a total product of his time, because he set out at an early age, even before the abuse, you know, stealing and rebelling and things like that. I think he kind of, you know, chose his path to a point. But I think what made him into a murderer was the abuse that he received at a young age. When he got sent to reform school, I mean, some of the things he got written up for, like talking in class and throwing crayons and throwing food, he received really bad punishments for. Whenever we would just say, hey, you don't do that, go to your room, you know, and they would beat the hell out of him. So, you know, that, I think at that point, he really started, you know, changing. That made him into the monster that he became.
You know, it's really interesting when we have these shows about Murder 1-2-3. So much of the time we find that these murderers were so victimized. I honestly don't think, other than maybe H.H. Holmes, potentially Jack the Ripper, potentially the most unbelievable mass murderer in history, up there in Chicago at the World's Fair, we find so many times that these folks, the murderers, were treated so badly, it's as if society created them. And Robin McRae, picked you. I made that statement because I wanted to ask you, because you're so good at reading people. How right is that statement that sometimes we as a society and the way we've let things run create the monsters in society?
Absolutely. I mean, our people are the worst. I mean, they really are. And we toss people aside like they're human waste. And when they do need anything, we toss them aside if it's too much trouble. And I think that that happens with a lot of people. And I think, you know, where some people can just roll it off and it might hurt for a while and they move on, other people can't do that. They don't have that mechanism in them, and they take it personally, and it creates anger and hatred and resentment, and it just, it blows out.
Mm-hmm. It does. And because we're so lucky to have Papa Stro with us, I have a follow-up question that goes directly to you. You have grown up in an industry of authoritarianism and respect in the professional wrestling world, correct?
Oh, yes.
What I would say, we've laughed about it, we've talked about it, but you and I have one mutual friend. I got to meet him for just a short time, for a couple times during a week, and you worked with him for a long, long period in your life, and that is Dusty Rhodes. When I was working with him and a group of people about putting a television show together, I was fortunate enough to get to have lunch with him and dinner with him in a week, and I got to learn a lot about the guy just being there and having dinner with him and lunch with him. It was a real privilege. And this was a man, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I want, he could get whatever he wanted from you, and he never had to yell, did he?
No, a lot of people didn't know about Dusty Rhodes, the fact that he was a mastermind behind the scenes of things. A lot of the best events in wrestling, televised events rather, was because of his genius behind the scenes creatively. He's helped create stars in the business. He would just bring out the best in you, right? And just come off as larger than life, if you will. I mean, just like you would a rock star type persona. And even with people in the industry, including yours truly, I mean, he would give those vibes off like he was head and heels above your ordinary pro wrestler, if you will, because he just had that aura about him, that charisma that you can't really teach anybody, you can't really show anybody. It's just staring some people. So, yeah, he was definitely one of a kind.
But he could frighten you to death. By just making
normal
statement.
Very intimidating, yes. Arn Anderson and quite a few others have told me, just sitting next to him, they were so intimidated by him because, I mean, sometimes he would just kind of look at you and you just didn't really know what to say. You get all choked up because,
awesome.
You realize this is his American dream sitting next to you, right? So.
And he was the American dream, and he could petrify you. I know you told me a story about this one poor boy that I think you pranked him and said you're late, and he about killed himself to get there. And the guy probably almost got killed on the road trying to get to this wrestling event when he was late, correct?
Oh, yeah. That was a silly rib. My friend from England, William Regal, he's my general manager for NXT that comes on every Wednesday nights on USA Network, right? He said a funny story about his first time meeting Dusty Rhodes, right? And this was not long after we got to be friends, right? Well, he's at the center stage in Atlanta, right? And he was summoned to the Dusty Rhodes office, right? He was handling things there for WCW. And he said he's sitting there looking like, in his words, looking like a melted sundae in a chair next to a big guy behind him, right? And he's sitting there looking across at Dusty Rhodes in the desk, right? And Dusty says, he just looks at him and says, "Steven, I'm just like Whitney Houston, baby. I got my own bodyguard." That's all he said. And Regal just looked at him and just nodded and said, like, okay, and just walked out the door, and that was it. He didn't know what to say after that. That's all Dusty told him.
And my point being, it's like, you know, I have a very important point here, is he put real terror into William Regal, didn't he? He was terrorized.
Regal didn't know what to say. He just nodded his head out the room, and that was it.
But Dusty Rhodes, being a master of psychology, could put terror into you that a beating and torture could never do.
Oh, yeah, he's just such a master at what he did. I mean, just the little things. I mean, just a true psychologist, just like my friend Jake Roberts. I mean, they're from the same mold.
And you know, here's the point. If you're, you know, you look at the way we allow people to run these reform schools and everything, and their way is to just beat the hell out of somebody, beat the hell out of a kid, and create a monster. When you can terrorize them to the point of no return, never touch them, I guarantee William Regal never did that again, did he? Never.
No. You know, you got people like Dusty Rhodes, Dick Roberts, and even Vince McMahon, if you will. There are a few cases like, you know, we perform and we get in the back. If Vince gives us a thumbs up, then, you know, we're relieved, right? Thank God, we'll go get a drink. If he's not, then we're in for a long night. We just by a simple look, you know.
Right. And it's a long night, and it's much worse than having the hell beat out of you. So I guess that's the point. Is when you look at the way these schools and institutions were back in the, well, I guess they really arose, well, pretty much right around the Civil War, right around the 1850s, and then they grew to these horrible things like the Charleston prison. And the way that they treated prisoners in the old Charleston jail was beyond belief. It was right about like what Pee Wee Gaskin and what Carl Panzeram got. And when it's a shame that they weren't smart enough to know how to handle them, how to punish them, and get a better person out of them. But then again, we lived in the wild, wild west. So, you know, three cheers to our panelists for talking about Carl Panzeram and for all of our listeners for understanding what went on. Poor boy, I'm going to ask Robin. I'm going to ask a question to Robin, a question to Tony, and a question to Papa Stroh. Robin, what happens when you're a kid and you have no hope, no choice, and it's going to happen to you every day?
Well, kids are going to fight back before anything is there to even fight. You're going to make sure that you get the first hit out before you get hit, whether it's emotionally or physically. And that turns you into an angry, violent person. And eventually, because you're so hurt, you put up this wall around you that nobody can penetrate. And you just get tougher all the time, and you get meaner because you can't stand the way life has dealt you this hand. And it just continues through your life.
It's just horrible. Well, that's what Carl faced. At least Carl, you know, I've got to say this. At least he was honest about it. He confessed to his crimes, and then he was ready to go. I think he had an idea that once he left this world and that life, it couldn't be any worse. So anyway, well, thank you for that. Now, Tony, what is your takeaway from that movie? I know I asked you a similar question, but as we wrap up the show, what is your real takeaway? And then Papa Stroh comes your question, and then I'll wrap it up. But Tony, what is your takeaway about Carl Panzeram the man?
I think that Carl Panzeram was a product of society, but I also think that he developed a taste for it. He enjoyed what he did because he didn't want it. He had several opportunities to stop, but he did not. He chose not to stop. He chose to continue with that lifestyle. So I think he developed a taste for it, whether he was just emotionally, mentally broken or whatever, or he's just an evil man, turned into an evil man. But he, I think that he developed a taste for the violence and the lifestyle.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, on the tail end of that, the next time we have our Surgeon General, Dr. Trey Donaway, on here, I want to ask him about Carl Pangram. I'll ask him to listen to our talk, because Carl's an interesting character. And it's like, it doesn't matter how bad their lives are, if we explore them the way we do, we see that it's just not all their fault. And people would say, oh, well, they should know better. Well, you know what? They don't always know better. Sometimes you don't know better unless you're trained. And maybe that's a horrible thing to say, but again, I'm afraid society creates its own monsters many, many times.
I agree.
And so, all right. And Papa Stro, I guess I'll just give you the, I'm going to give you the wild card question, because what do you think about Carl? And had you, because I know that you're a personality, you're a celebrity, you're also a counselor. You work with people, you have talked to kids, you've talked to young adults about how to do better, how to improve your lives. What would you have said had you met Carl Panzeri? I know it's a tough question, but I know you're up for it. Had you met Carl when he was 17 years old? He'd been in and out of, say, three or four prisons and a couple of and a couple of reform schools, and so he would have written down his occupation as thief. If you had had the opportunity back then to talk to him, what would have been the one thing that you would have said to him, the one piece of advice that could have helped? I hope that question, that's a difficult question, but I know you're up. What would you have said to him?
Well, I would, first off, you know, people that are abused like that, they feel all alone, like no one understands, no one cares, no one fully envisions what the pain and trauma they have gone through, and they don't feel like anybody would be there for them. And you have to sit down and let them know that they understand their pain, understand their anger, and identify what happened with them, and show them the point where you want to be, show them that you're there for them and you care and you want the best for them and have the best people around them that sincerely would help them instead of abuse them like they've had in the past. So you want to break the ice with them and saying, hey, you know, you want to identify and understand what they're going through and be there for them and legitimately help these people. I mean, that's especially people, you know, like we mentioned earlier with the mental illness that live with it each and every day. You know, they feel alone, and, you know, they don't feel like there's anybody that would want to reach out to them and understand, because they want someone there to be there for them in their time, in their dark times, and that's the problem, because no one wants to reach out to them, no one wants to help them or talk about it, etc. So, I mean, you would be amazed talking to people like that and letting out that anger and that emotion that they feel what they've gone through, because they need an outlet to vent. And if they don't have that outlet to vent and keeping that bottle up inside for so long, it'll drive anybody crazy. So you got to give them an outlet to vent and express all the hurt they've been through and let it out, man. It's just like hanging on to a pin, right? You squeeze in that pin, and that's all the anger, hate, and frustration in your life, right? But once you release that pin, the circulation gets back in your hand, you start to feel better, and you see somewhat of a relief. So you got to give that relief to that victim that's been going through all that suffering.
Thank you. And what I can say is, I mean, I really can't thank our panel tonight enough. I mean, I guess society creates its own, we create our own monster. We're responsible for it. What happens after that? Well, it's so unpredictable to see what happens. Carl Panzeri, You've got to have some empathy for him. Yes, he killed people. Yes, he did bad, very bad things to people. But, again, like Pee-wee Gaskin, who I have empathy for Pee-wee Gaskin. And I sure don't, to this day, I don't feel any weird vibes from Pee-wee, and I don't feel any weird vibes. Now, I felt bad vibes for Jake Holmes when the show was over,
yeah.
But I feel no bad vibes from Carl Panzeram, because Carl understands that we understand what happened. And I can guarantee you there's been no show about Carl Panzeram that spoke about him like this and tried to look at the things and see how society created the monster. The monster didn't attack society until society created the monster. And so I want to thank all three of you. I've got three of the most qualified people in the world in terms of life experience. They all know how to handle things. And I guess I have summarized. So I want to say thanks to everybody for being here on this very unusual episode that got cut in half of Murder 123 presented by ScaryCast. And as usual, I will do my call around to all of my co-hosts. And I want to thank all of you. Miss Robin, we're always glad to have you with us.
Aw, thank you.
You're such a light at the end of all the dark tunnels. Tony Pelosi, up there in the murder capital of the universe, Harlan, Kentucky. We couldn't do this without you.
I appreciate you, and I really have a great time, each and every time we do the show. And Papa Stroh, Robin, John, it's always, always an honor.
Oh, same here, Tony. We love you.
Yeah, me too, man.
And
you guys are the best.
To our guest,
thank you.
To our guest, Papa Stroh, who I've known 6 years. And I've known I have known Papa Stroh before I did podcasts, before I have known many, many of the people that I have known from before, and one of the people that I have been so thrilled to call a friend. Papa Stroh, thank you for being on here and giving us some of your advice and wisdom.
Thank you.
Because you... any time, buddy, because you have good advice. You have been through the world of experience, through one of the toughest industries in the world, professional wrestling, and you were there on top. When they lowered you and that grand piano down on that ring, that is one of the moments, one of the greatest moments in the history of your industry, and that was you, buddy. So thank you for being here with us. Always glad to have you anytime, and I will say, we'll see you guys next week. Now, Murder 123 will be back Monday night. Sometimes we have to postpone it because of things happening. And right now with the coronavirus, you know how things are. But thanks to everybody. We appreciate you being here. We'll see you next week. Well, we'll see you next Monday night on Murder 123 and next Thursday night on the most frightening thing in all of the Internet, ScaryCast. Thanks a lot. Bye, guys. Take care.
Night.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Yep.